from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out what's going on at VSA Arts of Indiana.
I'll chat with Richard Alden Clark, music professor and conductor of the Butler Symphony Orchestra.
And I'll talk with arts teacher and arts advocate, Clyde Gaw. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. An affiliate of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., VSA Arts of Indiana, Inc.'s goal is to create a society where people with disabilities learn through, participate in, and enjoy the arts. Travis DiNicola spoke with Jim Nolte, President and CEO of VSA Arts of Indiana, and Board Member Phil O'Malley about what's going on at VSA.
Jim, Phil, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure. What I'd like to start out with, I know we've got an event and some other cool stuff to talk about in just a little bit, but what I'd like to start out with first, Jim, is just briefly, what is VSA of Indiana?
Mm-hmm. VSA of Indiana is a statewide non-for-profit that provides arts experiences and programs for children and adults with disabilities. Our current mission is to provide access to lifelong learning and creative expression through the arts for people with disabilities.
And you've been in Indiana for about 30 years. You're actually part of a sort of a national organization that's connected with the Kennedy Center?
Right. VSA Arts is an educational affiliate of the JFK Center for the Performing Arts in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So most states have a full affiliate, which we represent here in Indiana. There are also offices of VSA Arts throughout 60 countries around the world.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't know that it was actually international as well.
Yes.
Most people, I think, probably in Indianapolis, where they may encounter you first is at the Harrison Center on First Fridays.
Yeah.
VSA Arts has a gallery space there where you show work created by your students. Is that also where your office is, or how does that function?
Right. We are currently in the Harrison Center. Unfortunately, our gallery is no longer. We had to move out of that space due to budget cuts this year. So we actually lost the physical space of a gallery. We've moved the work of our clients, our students, into the hallways of our administrative area. But, yes, the Harrison Center rents us a certain amount of space for the administrative offices. And then we have four accessible studios for art to be made or art process to happen. We do ceramic work, 2D visual arts work, theater, and music at the Harrison Center.
So those are all at the Harrison. Do you also do things on-site at other locations? Or because you do serve the state, technically.
Right, yeah. We do. And we have statewide partners throughout the state in Muncie and Terre Haute and Evansville, South Bend. There are offices, non-for-profits, that serve individuals with disabilities, and we try to send seed money into those non-for-profits for them to create arts experiences, arts programs for individuals with challenges in those areas.
And certainly every individual client you work with is very different, but in general, why is it important, do you believe, for individuals with disabilities to have an mm-hmm. opportunity to work in the arts?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well,
is it art mm-hmm. therapy? Is it a vocation? It's
all of those. We are not specific certified therapists. However, the work that we do is definitely therapeutic in that it makes things better. Our target audience is an individual that faces a challenge, And it might be cognitive, it might be physical, it might be emotional. And the arts become an avenue for expression and education. The arts actually allow a lot of the kids that we serve who are qualified for special ed services to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for instance, a child with a learning disability. Doesn't mean that that child can't learn, but learns in different ways. The arts become that pathway to learning. The arts allow the access to learning.
Phil, you're nodding your head on that one. You certainly agree with that.
Yeah, what Jim was saying is, you know, the arts introduce proven methods for effective learning. And we separate often science and math, but science and math are not counter to the arts. For several individuals, the arts are the best way in which they learn, whether it's through music, theater, movement, all visual arts.
Well, let me ask you this, because you mentioned the affiliation with the Kennedy Center.
Yes.
And so then my thoughts go to, well, if you guys are affiliated with the Kennedy Center, you've got a budget from the federal government that covers absolutely everything, right?
Well, that's not the case. As a matter of fact, dollars coming out of Washington for the arts in general are moving slower and slower, mm-hmm. and smaller amounts coming out from our federal government. VSA here in the state of Indiana has historically been funded by the Indiana Department of Education,
okay.
through the Division of Exceptional Learners until this year. And that's where our budget took the blow when we discovered in July of this past year, July 2009, that the Indiana Department of Education was really focusing their resources away from arts education for children with disabilities, concentrating more on achievement in math and science. And this isn't just something that's happening in Indiana. Mm-hmm. That focus on math and science scores is a national frenzy right
sure.
now. The point I'd like to make, Travis, is that the children that are most vulnerable to not learning are children with special needs. And when you would take a dollar and divert it from the opportunity for that child to express themselves or to access academics through the arts, then you've made a mistake. And so what VSA is doing is now trying to focus on what we do best, which is to give that opportunity for expression through the arts, give access to learning through the arts. But we are in the midst of finding new revenue streams to do so.
And let me just be clear, the funding that you used to receive from the Department of Education that had been coming to you for about 30-some years or so, that was
yes.
a pretty large percentage of your budget, correct?
Yes, that is over 75% of our budget.
And at this point, there's no immediate going back. I mean, there's no lobbying to say, mm-hmm. like, oh, restore the budget. I mean, pretty much at least mm-hmm. in the short term, that decision has been made.
It has. And the dollars that came into VSA Arts of Indiana were discretionary Part B funds. And that's federal dollars that comes into a state mm-hmm. and can be expended at the discretion of the Department of Education. Now, unfortunately, at their discretion, they've decided to move those dollars away from children with disabilities
right.
being given the opportunity to express themselves.
And with all the other cuts the Department of Ed's going to be going through in the next couple months as well, I mean,
right.
we don't see any near future, very unfortunately, where those funds are going to be coming back to VSA.
Exactly.
So that means you have to make some pretty significant changes in your model, because there's no doubt that the need is still there,
right?
For you to continue your work, and so I mean, this is an enormous task for you to undertake. I know, and
it is,
and for your board.
Yes, and we've been working really hard to figure out what we can do with about 25% of what we used to have, to a point of trying to figure out how we can pay the rent. We're downsizing in the Harrison Center. As I said, we let go of our gallery space. We still show the work of our students, but in the hallways rather than in a gallery. We are looking at alternative ways to bring dollars in to fund what we do. Some of that might be fees for service. So if you are a school system or a particular school that would like our artists to come in and work with your children, that can be arranged, but it will cost some dollars.
Sure.
Because those dollars have been taken out of our budget. Also, my board of directors, Phil here being a prime example, are really taking hold and getting some work done by way of looking at special events and mm-hmm. ways to bring dollars into VSA Arts.
And recognition as well.
I mean,
exactly. Certainly special events are sometimes great for raising money, sometimes they're difficult, but they can certainly always bring attention to the organization. And it sounds as though, really for VSA Arts to continue to survive, it's going to be those individual donors that I know you probably didn't really aggressively go after before when you were getting the state funds.
Right, and it's a different day today.
Mm-hmm.
Our organization, actually, I always say it was blessed by the Department of Education for the past 30 years
mm-hmm.
in their providing the resources for us to expand to include music and theater and all art forms in the lives of children with disabilities. We would do that not only in school settings, but at the Harrison Center. We have a program at Riley Hospital. All of these programs are now at risk unless we can find resources to help our
right.
kids.
Now, the positive news is that for all those years, it really allowed you to focus on programming. You know,
yeah.
many organizations, you know, unfortunately have to spend so much time focusing on fundraising, the programming sometimes gets a little bit forgotten. So for all that time, you got that support, you were able to develop, you know, great models of great programs, but now it's a matter of how do you keep them going. And certainly, you know, as you said, through events and other things, Phil, I know that, you know, there's a pretty big event coming up, in fact, fairly soon, that the board's working on that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, actually, it is, let's see, opening is February 26th, Friday night, from 6 to 9 at Ashland Gallery in Broad Ripple, which is at 6537 North Carrollton, about a block and a half north of a Distance Limited Gallery. And it'll run through the month of March, March being Disabilities Awareness Month. It will feature paintings, works by Lois Main Templeton, myself, John McKee, the gallery manager, local artist, and Stu Johnson. Stu is featured there. He has Down syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and I am just absolutely amazed by his work that he produces. So all of the proceeds from that, it will go directly to VSA.
Excellent.
And at the same time, bring awareness to individuals. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be a lovely little event. It's an old home that's been renovated, and it's a nice spot to visit.
And there's information about that show on your website at vsa.org, is that correct?
VSAI.org.
VSAI.org,
yes.
That's right. Let me make sure I got that right, VSAI.org. And I'm also assuming that, you know, for other artists who would like to be involved donating their time, or for individual donors, they could also get information through VSAI.org?
Yes, exactly. There is a page on our website that refers to Friends of VSA. And if you click on that site or that page, you'll be able to give a contribution to help our programs. Or as Phil said, we hope to have this event, which is coming up February 26th, and others to follow it. The Broad Ripple Village Association in May has their spring tour of galleries. They'll be showing some of the work of our students and have that for sale also. So what VSA Arts of Indiana has seen is a community that is starting to respond to the loss of quality services. We will not let these services leave our community. Our children need them, as well as their families, adults with disabilities. So we haven't given up. We've turned a corner. We're
mm-hmm.
struggling, and we certainly need everyone's help in doing this.
And I think it's important, too, that, you know, for the community to help something survive and maybe even just thrive would be wonderful, not just survive. They have to know what they're losing. And going to the website, there's an awful lot of information, incredible amount of information of what VSA of Indiana accomplishes on the board. I'm very, very impressed. Each time I go to the website, I find something new that I wasn't aware of. the services.
Well, it's certainly a great organization that has a and has had a huge impact, and I know will continue to have an impact on the community. And but certainly now is a time for people to rally behind you as much as possible in any way. And I wish you both the best of luck with that.
Thank you very much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Jim Nulty, President and CEO of VSA Arts of Indiana, and board member Phil O'Malley. For more information, visit vsai.org. Again, vsai.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Richard Alden Clark knows classical music, but he believes that other kinds of music should have a place in his students' curricula, too. Clark studied at the Manhattan School of Music and founded the Manhattan Chamber Orchestra, which he still leads, in 1987. But the associate professor of music and conductor of the Butler Symphony Orchestra also has credits that include performing in Broadway orchestras, on Saturday Night Live, with Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page and Sean Puff Daddy Combs, and on Aerosmith's hit I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. And he has made more than 30 recordings, has conducted more than 100 world premiere performances, and is the youngest conductor ever to appear at Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, practice. Sharon Gamble invited Maestro Clark to our studios to conduct an interview.
All right, before we talk about the planets and the concert, I want to know how you started in music. How did music grab a hold of you? How did you know you were a musician?
Well, you know, I owe everything to the public school system. I grew up
really?
In upstate New York. Public schools had a phenomenal music program. And like most musicians, you just need one teacher to really take an interest in you.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a wonderful jazz guitarist who was head of the string program at the elementary school. And he came around with the string instruments to all the fourth graders. And I grabbed Aww. The violin, and I've never let go of it.
What appealed to you? Had you heard violin music? Did you know something about the instrument?
I knew
or
nothing about it. It just
like
I saw the violin, and I wanted it. It was very funny. And after then, I started spending every little, you know, allowance and money from Grandma and buying LPs in those days.
Uh-huh.
And I would buy violin albums, and my parents thought, wow, this is some kind of weird fad he's going through, but we'll see what happens.
Well, that kind of answers my next logical question, which is, are there other musicians in the family? Was somebody kind of coaxing you or nudging you in that direction?
There was always an appreciation of music, but, you know, my parents grew up with the big band music.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up hearing in the house, you know, Glenn Miller, Tommy Dorsey, Harry James, great stuff like that. And my brothers all went the rock and roll, you know, playing all the hippie music in
Are
the
they
house.
Older?
Yeah,
they're
I'm,
older.
I'm the baby of four. Okay. Yeah, and so, in fact, I remember vividly my brother once taking my violin bow, putting it in the door, and snapping it in half. So
oh,
it was one
I
of those kind
got,
of households.
I hope he got in serious. All three of your older siblings are boys?
Yeah.
I'm
my
so
poor
sorry.
Mother. I didn't appreciate her until much later in life when I realized what she went through. But at least she had one normal child, the one who played the violin.
There you go. But, man, you must have gotten a lot of grief from those older siblings.
I tell you, you know, until I learned how to fiddle, it was rough. And then when I could fiddle, people thought that was pretty cool.
Really?
And I remember once playing at a talent show in high school, and I started with something classical, and the kids actually started to boo. And then when it broke into fast, gypsy fiddling, they went crazy for it, and I wound up winning the talent show, you know. But it was like,
what a great ambassador you were.
Well, yeah, you bring you know, different kinds of music to them. But it was funny. I was such a little classical nerd, and now in my career, some of the fun highlights as a studio musician has been playing with Aerosmith, playing on Saturday Night Live, being on The Letterman Show, playing with Randy Newman, and being a concertmaster for people like Johnny Mathis and Bobby Vinton, and all these cool stars throughout the years, and meeting wonderful celebrities, and playing movie soundtracks and all. And so it's like, you know, that classical nerd didn't really work, and it wasn't until I got out of college that I really experienced all this other great, great music.
Now, you've just described a vast array of styles and kinds of music. Do you do anything differently to prepare for, you know, studio recording with Aerosmith as opposed to a gig where you're playing Beethoven?
You know, it's a different mindset. The approach to the instrument is the same, and that's something, if you told me when I was a college kid, I would have said, you're crazy, you know, because this is how you play the violin,
mm-hmm.
and all the other stuff is no good. I mean, it was that kind of arrogance that a conservatory breeds. And then when you get exposed to all the other materials, you see great artistry. It doesn't matter where the voice is at, it's great artistry. And it wasn't until then that I appreciated great jazz artists really great rock and roll, and to see the virtuosity and the kind of genius that went into all this different kind of music. And I fall in love with all of it. But, 25 years ago, I would have said, nah, I'm not listening to any of that.
I see Leonard Bernstein on your shoulder saying, all good music is serious.
You know, he was an idol of mine, and I was very fortunate to see him many times with the New York Philharmonic and go and watch him work at Juilliard and do master classes and work with young conductors. And everything about him was incredible. He's my ultimate idol in classical music.
With meaning no disparaging of Indianapolis, I have to ask the question that some of our listeners probably have in their heads right now. Wow, you left New York. You left that scene you've just described. You left the Manhattan Chamber Orchestra, which you founded in 87. Well, you haven't left it, but you came out here to take on this role at Butler University. What was it about Butler that lured you away?
Well, you know,
it's a different kind of life here.
It totally different. It was a little shocking at first. It was hard for me to adjust being a New York boy, you know. But I love teaching, and I love having my own orchestra of students. And the East Coast, some of the universities were very hard hit, especially in New Jersey, where the financial crisis has really leveled them pretty bad.
Yeah.
And Manhattan School, it was a part-time teaching job. Everybody there is kind of like an adjunct, and I loved the school. But I had been there for 15 years, and the challenge was kind of wearing thin. You know, it was a kind of been there, done that.
Mm-hmm.
The way the economy had turned, and of course what happened in 2001 in New York City, it hurt a lot of performing organizations. The commercial world has really taken a dive. Broadway has taken a dive.
Sure.
They don't use the size orchestras and the live strings that they used to do. The Broadway producers are equivalent to the Wall Street greed whores there, pardon my language.
And there's a lot of synthesizers in the pit.
Yeah,
now,
and they think
the big
people
Broadway
don't know
shows.
The difference.
Right.
It's
yeah.
a crime.
Yeah.
And so I was looking for a place to settle down and make music in a good environment. And Butler has a beautiful program. And I have great kids. I'd put them up against any conservatory in the country anytime.
Was there a moment when you came out? Obviously, a position like this requires several site visits and interviews mm-hmm. and so forth. Was there a moment when you were listening to the kids or hearing something that people who were about to be your fellow faculty members said where you said, aha, this is it?
You know, as part of the audition, I got to conduct the students and work with them. And in that half hour, it seemed like only 2 minutes had gone by when they said, okay, time's up on that one.
Wow.
I just so enjoyed working with the students. But I'll tell you, the first 3 years were very difficult. It was not an easy transition because I kind of came with my conservatory ideals and my New York upbringing,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't work. It didn't work at all. So I had a very bumpy ride at Butler. But, you know, you have certain administrative people and certain faculty people who are genuine mentors,
mm-hmm.
and it takes a lot for a person after they've accomplished a certain amount in their career. I mean, I had, 35, 40 recordings out, played
right,
on national
right.
television, done international
you,
tours.
I think you started at 7.
Yeah.
Look at the discography and go, wait a minute,
a lot of
how
album.
Did you do that?
And so it was hard to kind of step back and go, you know, you may have accomplished all this, but this is a different place and a different kind of environment. And I had great mentors at Butler who help you refine your teaching skills. And when that happened, I got a terrific orchestra now. The orchestra is first rate at Butler, and I've taken them to New York to play.
Right.
Now, we just did a huge Mahler festival. I mean, these kids were doing Mahler, too. And everybody looks back at their college days with great fondness and thinks, yeah, when we did that, it was great. I was at a conservatory. Man, I'll put my kids' performance against any conservatory in the country. They did a phenomenal job. And that's more rewarding than saying, well, you know, I've conducted in Carnegie Hall, I've played here and there. Well, it's very nice, but you don't really change anything. You don't really affect anybody else. It's
shaped,
great for the ego.
You've shaped musicians.
Yeah, and here you've got such smart, talented kids in so many different areas. They're much more interesting than conservatory kids who are kind of very, locked into one thing. I'm studying my Bach, my Mozart, and conservatories still haven't made that great leap into what we were just talking about. All music is great music. In fact, while I was at Manhattan School, I was forbidden to do any other kinds of music. My teacher wouldn't allow it. I only did the classics, and I studied the violin.
Now, wait a minute. How long ago was that?
This was in the early 80s.
That's not
in
that
fact,
long ago.
Most schools, only in the last 15, 20 years, developed degree programs in jazz. Can you believe it's been that long before school really acknowledged jazz as a great art form and we're giving advanced degrees in it? And so we've come a long, long way, and it's the universities who are shining the light and showing, you know, we need to educate the whole person, not just, hey, you play the violin really well, but there's no room in the world for you because that's all you do and you don't understand anything else. And Butler, for me, is an incredible resource, and it's taught me an amazing amount.
There is truly a sense that I'm getting from you that Butler lives up to its reputation as a liberal arts college, meaning not just, and that's arts plural, that means the whole person.
Yeah, first rate. Well, you know, and this is horrible to say, but the honest truth is, again, being that conservatory snob, and you don't realize how much you're really in a vacuum, that you have no idea what's going on around you. I'd never heard of Butler when I first came out here. I saw the job listing. Several people had heard of Butler, said, it's a great school, you should apply. And I thought, God, do I really want to leave New York?
Why would I go to the Midwest but not to Chicago?
Yeah, exactly.
Or Cincinnati, or CCM.
Well, yeah, but you know what? And Cincinnati's a great school. I sent many students there when they graduated from Rutgers. They've got nothing on Butler, you know? I think it used to be, when I was a student, conservatory or die. If you didn't make Juilliard or Manhattan or Curtis or Eastman or Big IU or Michigan, then you didn't have a chance. And that's just not true. That's a myth. And now these universities have developed such great faculties, and they have such wonderful resources. The kinds of programs, the kind of collaborative events that I've done at Butler, I never could have done at Manhattan School. The education my students are getting, I didn't get in a conservatory. I had great teachers on the violin. I loved it. But I look what my students are doing and what my students are exposed to, and I'm a little jealous. They're getting better than what I got.
Get in the Wayback Machine and enroll at Butler.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy to be a part of that. But it took several years to convince me of that. You know, you gotta break old habits, you know, it's not easy. But I'm just loving the place.
As our listeners are hearing this, their next opportunity to hear your fabulous kids is in a concert featuring the Planets. I don't think I've ever met somebody who's heard the Planets and hasn't fallen in love with at least a few movements.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's 100 years ahead of its time. If it hadn't been for that piece, there would have been no Star Wars score and all those space movies and all that. I mean, what Holst envisioned at the early part of this century is brilliant, and everybody's copied them ever since.
How do you get that across to the kids?
You know,
who have grown up not knowing that that's a game-changing piece.
You bring that to them in rehearsals. What I like about this setting, working with my kids, is it's not just let's prepare the piece for a concert. We talk about theory, we talk about history, we talk about other performances. But what's so incredible nowadays that you and I didn't benefit from when we were students is everything is accessible now. They can just type it in and see it live taping on YouTube.
Sure.
They can go on Amazon and order 100 different recordings of it. They can just put it into Wikipedia or whatever it is there and get all this information on it. And, you know, we struggled. I mean, it's no wonder why so many things had become obscure. Of course, not the Planets, but hundreds of composers forgotten about that are now being unearthed, that are now available on recordings that were never there. How many artists can put forth their work? You know, everybody's ready to put a nail in the coffin of the business of classical music. I experienced it in New York. You know, things were dying on a certain end, which is why I jumped ship. But it's a whole new realm. It's, you know, the internet, the technology, anybody can become a recording artist now. Anybody can write their music, produce it, film it, put it out there, and have an audience for it. And so my kids, they're pretty sharp already. They've got a good background on this music, and I give them the program information way ahead of time. And most of them are pretty earnest about finding out, getting copies of recordings, and talking about other performances they've heard, other conductors doing it, the differences in performances, the different styles, how if you listen to a Von Karajan recording, it might take 6 minutes longer than a Leonard Bernstein recording. And that's great, because then now more than ever also they begin to see that almost every kind of performance or style is acceptable. Not, this is what my teacher says, this is how I play it, and this is the only way to do it.
There's no one legitimate way.
Right. But you know, it was kind of that way when you were a conservatory kid, you know, 25, 30 years ago. I mean, that's unfair to say in a certain respect, But it really is true. You know, you do get straitjacketed into this is the way to do it. And different schools of playing, different schools of thought. I remember there was a war between the big violin teacher at Manhattan School, which was Bronstein, who I adored, and the whole Galamian way of playing, which was at Juilliard. But the funny thing is, so many students were going back and forth and studying with the other master privately, secretly, because the young people knew there's not just one way. But the old guys, those great mentors, why, they couldn't see eye to eye ever.
You have the makings of an opera right there.
Exactly. Well, you know, a funny thing you mentioned that. I'm actually writing an opera based on a play of Kurt Vonnegut's. I was a longtime associate with him in New York, and he gave me the rights to an opera, Happy Birthday, Wanda June, a play of his.
Yeah, sure.
And we were working diligently on the libretto, and we finished it in February, and in March he had a fatal fall.
Right,
he
right.
was in a coma, and in April he had passed away in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
But I have at least 4 or 5 albums out on collaborations with Kurt Vonnegut. He was a dear, dear friend, and he always thought this play should be an opera, and that's the latest endeavor out here. I'm hoping to find the time and peace to write an opera.
Sharon Gamble with Richard Alden Clark, who teaches violin, viola, and conducting at Butler University's Jordan College of Fine Arts, and conducts the Butler Symphony Orchestra and maintains an international conducting career. You can hear the BSO play Gustav Holst's The Planets on Sunday, February 28th at 3 p.m. at Clues Memorial Hall. The concert is free and no tickets are required.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
We're going to do something a little different today and use some music with our calendar segment.
I thought this sounded different.
Yes, that
I like it.
That illustrates why you should not take your younger brother's violin bow and snap it in the door.
I'll keep that in
because
mind.
Because your younger brother might grow up to be someone like Richard Alden Clark, whose Manhattan Chamber Orchestra we're listening to. We'll hear a couple of movements during our calendar segment. We are hearing right now the air from the Holberg Suite, and in a little bit we'll hear the Larghetto from the Elgar Serenade for Strings, Opus 20, the Manhattan Chamber Orchestra, one of many, many MCO recordings. But
very cool.
While we're listening to the music, we have some things for you to go out and do.
On that calendar we call,
What do we do?
The Concert to Benefit World Food Program. You can't go wrong with that.
Wow, that's cool.
Yep, Friends of the World Food Program are having a concert performed by the Indianapolis Children's Choir and hosted by the World Food Program Committee. And this 90-minute concert that's going to feature a whole bunch of different choruses directed by Henry Leck and the Indianapolis Youth Chorale as well, directed by Cheryl West, is taking place Sunday, March 7th. 2 p.m. out at the Pike Performing Arts Center, and tickets are available at Marsh or at the door, and it is a fundraiser for the World Food Program. Again, March 7th at Pike Performing Arts Center.
Excellent cause. Hey, you know about the Hoosier Salon, but maybe you don't know that the Hoosier Salon is participating regularly in a First Friday exhibit that will go on every month this year except for October. And this coming First Friday, which is March 5th from 6 to 9, you can see a Hoosier Salon show at the Morris Butler House at 1204 North Park Avenue, featuring works by Gene McLeish, Mark Burnett, Douglas Ryan, and Rick Wilson. And if you've never been to the Morris Butler House, it's a little bit hard to find the first time. Leave your trail of breadcrumbs. It's tucked in just north of the interstate. But do a little map quest, and you can find out how to get to 1204 North Park Avenue and see on First Friday, March 5th, a Hoosier Salon exhibit.
There you go. Hey, a concert that's coming up this week on Wednesday the 24th at the Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center is the Brooklyn Rider. Have you heard of them?
They are
chamber music
very
group.
Cool, yeah, but kind of modern and hip.
Yeah, and one of the pieces they're doing is a Philip Glass piece, which should be very,
Philip
very
Glass,
fun.
Philip Glass.
Nicely
old
done.
Joke.
So they are performing. This is part of the Ensemble Music International Chamber Series. And, again, it is taking place on Wednesday, the 24th, 7:30 p.m., down at the History Center.
You know, if you Google NPR Tiny Desk, you can find out more about them.
That's right. They were just featured, right, mm-hmm. Recently with some of their music.
Exactly. You got it.
Brooklyn Rider next Wednesday.
Brooklyn Rider. Good deal. Travis, this is the time of year when you or maybe your lovely bride Might look around the house and say, we have too much stuff. Let's get rid of some stuff. Let's clean out some closets. Does that
have
ever
you been listening
in
on our conversations?
The cats have been calling me and reporting. Well, if you find yourself, dear listener, in that same situation, here's something you can do with your excess clothes. Of course, if they're in good shape, you might want to donate them to one of the many good causes where they can be resold and raise money for good things, but if they're not in very good shape, you might want to figure out how to turn them into a rag rug. What? Yeah, seriously. This is one of those cool workshops at the Indianapolis Art Center. The workshop is on Saturday, March 6th and Sunday, March 7th. The workshop, you'll want to be there both days. It's 9 to 3 the first day on Saturday and noon to 6 on the second day. But you're going to leave this workshop with your very own rag rug that you have created by recycling the fabric out of some of those clothes and other fabric items that you don't need. It's called Not Your Great-Grandmother's Rag Rug
That's
Workshop.
That's pretty cool.
It is very cool. And a woman named Nina Macchia will lead you in that workshop. And you can hang the rug on the wall or actually use it at the end of the workshop. And all sorts of cool stuff.
I was thinking about making a rag rug out of all the cat hair that gets shed in our
house. Know,
could we do that? Is that kind of
maybe the listing doesn't say that, but you know, she sounds like a pretty creative lady.
Yeah.
So, for more information, you can go to the Indianapolis Art Center's website, which is indplsartcenter.org. So, Inplus Art Center, the old fashioned shortening of Indianapolis, inplusartcenter.org, and look for not your great grandmother's rag rug workshop.
Well, sounds cool.
I know.
Hey, opening next week in the continuing series that's part of the IRT Going Solo Festival, the play written by David Hoppe, titled After Paul McCartney, is opening on Wednesday the 24th. And again, it was written by David Hoppe from Nuvo, features Rob Johansson, directed by Rob Green, and it is part of this Going Solo Festival 3 one-person plays that also includes Pretty Fire and The Year of Magical Thinking, all running together now in tandem, or repertoire, as you would have it, I guess, through March 14th.
Scoop, Muck, Lofty, Roly, Dizzy, Benny, and Scrambler, as well as Bob, want you to join them.
I know some of those guys. Where have they all been hanging out?
I feel as though we've entered a fairy tale here. Not exactly, but we have entered the world of Bob the Builder. Bob and Wendy and the rest of the crew are inviting you to come help build a house, plant a flower garden, and, as they say on radio and TV, much, much more. This is part of the Bob the Builder Project Build It at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. And if you don't have small kids, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. But trust me, borrow a child and go to the Children's Museum and find out all about Bob the Builder.
Sounds good. Speaking of fairy tales and kids, Aladdin Jr. is at Beef and Board's Dinner Theater. It's a live theater for kids production that's on stage now through March 20th. It's the Pyramid Players presenting this high flying, of course, because there is that flying carpet, which I'm sure they probably made themselves out of leftovers.
They recycled
from
it from the rag rug workshop.
See, it all comes together here. anyway, if you would like more information about Aladdin Jr., which is taking place up at Beef and Boards, then you can get more information by going online to beefandboards.com.
Hey, I have it on good authority from Scott Greenwell, who's the narrator in that production, that it's absolutely charming, and not just for children, so grown-ups
Very
can go
good.
Too. So after you take your kid to Bob the Builder, you can go see the Aladdin Jr. But if you get really, really good at making that rag rug out of recycled cat fur or whatever materials you have at hand at your house, you might end up being one of the artists in the future Indiana Art Fair. The 7th annual Indiana Art Fair is going on right now at the Indiana State Museum. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and it's just like a small version of Penrod or Broad Ripple Art Fair, but it's inside. There are 93 local artists, and I always find all sorts of things that I need, quote-unquote, need when I go there. And it's indoors, and you can find something to brighten up a winter day. Indiana Art Fair at the Indiana State Museum, and take in the Lincoln exhibits while you're there.
That's right. Hey, last thing I want to mention is just a reminder that Keeping Company, an art show benefiting VSA of Indiana, talked about this a little bit earlier, featuring the art of Louis Maine Templeton and Stu Johnson, Phil O'Malley, and John McKee, opens on February the 26th, and it runs through the end of March at the Ashland Gallery in Broad Ripple. Ashland Gallery, studio.com for more information.
My last item concerns 18th century furniture design. If you're looking for inspiration, maybe you want to do a little redesigning of your own home, look to the past and go to this free exhibition at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. You can see more than 30 18th century prints of furniture design from France, Germany, and a lot from England, as well as related pieces of furniture all drawn from the IMA's permanent collection, all different styles represented, and I'm sure that you'll come out with some inspiration to rearrange your own home, and maybe you'll even figure out a place to put down your recycled
carpet.
Rag rug. It all goes together, doesn't it?
We'll be back with more ideas of things to recycle and to go to in the arts on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Art teacher Clyde Gaw is also the advocacy advisor for the Art Education Association of Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with him to find out what the state of arts education is in our state and what we can all do to help improve it.
Clyde, you're an art teacher at New Palestine. When you were on the show before, we were talking a lot about the importance of art education in the schools, and certainly we're going to be talking about that today, but more specifically, you are here in your role as the advocacy advisor for the Art Education Association of Indiana. Let's first start out with, what is the Art Education Association?
The Art Education Association of Indiana is an affiliate of the National Art Education Association. So AEAI represents over 500 art teachers and art educators throughout the state of Indiana.
And this is part of the whole national network that both advances arts education, certification, curriculum, national conferences, professional organization, all those sort of things.
Absolutely. We're made up of primarily of art teachers, but also museum educators and administrators, school administrators who are art advocates also.
And certainly even professors of art education in our schools that are teaching other teachers how to teach art or teach art educators.
Absolutely.
Right.
I forgot that that very important piece of our membership is the art education professors throughout the state, and we have many fine, brilliant art education professors in the state, including Bob Sable, who's our National Association President-elect and currently our state president, Brad Venable of Indiana State.
And I do want to be clear, when we're talking about art education here, we are talking about the visual arts. This is not necessarily music or theater or performing arts, dance for that matter. We're talking about visual arts, painting, drawing, three-dimensional sculpture. And I know you're a guy who thinks in images, so I appreciate you being on the radio talking in words with me today.
That's exactly it. There can be a wide variety of hands-on visual experiences taking place in art education today.
Okay. Now, your role as advocacy advisor, what exactly does that mean? Because my guess is that it has something to do with funding here, correct? And the role that state funding plays in arts education?
Yeah, absolutely, Travis. We try to keep track of issues related to school funding. We're all busy art teachers, our membership is, and so what I've been doing, and with my committee and with the rest of the membership, we try to keep tabs on funding issues that affect local school corporations. And really, there's been a big change in public education. As you know, in 2008, property tax reform passed, and now public schools primarily get all of their funding from the state. I know there's a portion of it that comes from the federal government, but local communities, they now channel their funds directly to the state, and the state is now the mediary of doling out those funds.
And of course, we've heard a lot about the $300 million that the schools have to cut.
Absolutely, and that's where we're experiencing a contraction right now in program offerings across schools, across a lot of the curricular offerings in school districts.
And unfortunately, because the way that the school systems are set up, with so much emphasis being put on standardized testing, the ISTEP tests, which do not test a subject like the arts, subjects that are not being tested are often the first to go when cuts have to be made. And so there is a very real and immediate threat to arts education in our schools right now.
Unfortunately, that's true, Travis. And we've been documenting since 2006, there have been marginalizations, cuts taking place in school districts across the state. And what we observe is, you know, not sometimes the cuts are big, but generally they occur in very small cuts. And so what we see is a trend that we don't want to see, and that's the death of art education through 1,000 or 1,000,000 little cuts, mm-hmm. which is what we don't want to see.
Do you see it as a trend that those cuts are just getting larger, or because I know that there's actually some legislation that's in discussion right now that's going to have an immediate effect on the arts?
House Bill 1367 and Senate Bill 309 are currently being discussed and negotiated in the General Assembly right mm-hmm. now, and we are hopeful that one of these two emergency education funding bills will be able to provide a stopgap measure for cuts that we fear are going to take place, and programs that we know will get cut, because superintendents and school boards by law have to make cuts right now. But
right.
we're hopeful that once this emergency legislation passes, that the school boards will and administrations will see to it to reinstate programs that they once had to cut.
Okay, so you mentioned a House bill and a Senate bill. Can you tell me just briefly again about each one specifically?
House Bill 1367 is a piece of legislation that would allow flexibility for school districts in how to reallocate their education funds, their
okay.
school funds. And I know it's a complicated matter how school funding is allocated. There are five distinct funds.
But flexibility sounds like a good thing. It's giving control to within the school district itself.
Absolutely. And
okay.
so there also 1367 would allow those school districts who have surpluses to help out school districts who do not.
Okay.
Because each school district as a separate entity is, some are in good fiscal shape and some are not.
Sure.
And so this $300 million statewide shortfall is affecting each school district a
right.
little bit differently. And some are able to handle it better than others.
Let's talk about the Senate bill briefly. What is that one?
That bill would also be beneficial to in providing new monies. The difference between that I see is that it directly affects teacher benefits and pay, and
okay.
that it would freeze teacher pay and freeze teacher benefits, and also affect the incremental pay raises that teachers receive, which has been the way since 1973 that teachers have been paid for their for in their profession.
So these two, the House bill and the Senate bill, these are the two immediate concerns that that you have, as well as the Arts Education Association of Indiana, to make sure that these emergency stopgap funding measures do get passed. So that at least at this point we can sort of put a thumb in the dike, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. We're hopeful that when the economy comes around and the state's ability to collect more funds through a robust economy and through I know there was a shortfall in the tax assessments this year, and I'm no expert in that area, but I just know that the economy is the main reason we're suffering from this cut.
For parents who are listening who want to make sure that arts education funding continues in their school, what would you have them do?
What you could do right now is contact your local legislator, your state legislators in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and encourage them to support emergency school funding measures. And you can access them through the in.gov website.
Sure.
And click on General Assembly, and you can locate your local legislator. Once that emergency legislation passes to help our schools, if you know that your local school district has cut an art program, by all means, you should contact your local school board and suggest or insist that those programs be reinstated if, in fact, they were cut.
And the arts remain a part of education.
Travis DiNicola with arts teacher and arts advocate Clyde Gaw. Gaw is the advocacy advisor for the Art Education Association of Indiana. To learn more, either visit the AEAI website at aeai.org, again, aeai.org, or Clyde's blog at savearteducation.blogspot.com. Again, savearteducation.blogspot.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll find out about Music for All's next big event.
I'll get a preview of the Indiana Art and Antiques Show.
And I'll get the scoop on IUPUI's Genesis magazine. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.